8:14 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. In the studio with us now, Cheryl Fox, Executive Director of Summit Land Conservancy. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's see. There you go. That microphone.
Good morning.
Yeah. So you've got a big challenge here. You're looking for money to try and save or at least purchase the conservation easement on the Oscarthorpe Farm there on Old Ranch Road, and time's running out.
That's right. So we have received $8.7 million, or $8.7 million has been allocated to save that property on Old Ranch Road. It's big. It's 158, almost 160 acres. And it is the green fields that people see as they bike or drive along Old Ranch Road where there's a pivot and it's irrigated. The family will continue to farm it, so it will continue to be a farm on Old Ranch Road, which is in keeping with the Snyderville Basin General Plan, which designates that property as a heritage amenity. And it also designates, it also says several times in the Basin's General Plan that the ideal would be to work with existing agricultural producers to maintain the agricultural uses on the property.
So you're saying if you don't raise that $5.5 million, then you have to walk away?
Well, we have another $5.5 million that has to be raised, right? Because the federal government, you know, doesn't pay for the entire thing, and they shouldn't. So the family is putting in almost $3.5 million towards the transaction. And then we need to raise another $5.5 million. So we are out actively looking for that right now. And we have a deadline of March of 2018. And the reason for that is because the family has a situation where they need to meet an obligation. And this obligation is something that they've inherited and through sort of no fault of their own. But it means that it's a pretty steep financial obligation. And if they can't meet it, you know, many families in this situation would just say, fine, whatever, and put up a for sale sign. And it's a real testament to the Oscarthorpe's commitment to farming and commitment really to the values that this community shares of the open space and the agricultural land, that they are working really, really hard to find a solution that maintains their agricultural business, maintains the open space on Old Ranch Road, you know, and at a pretty steep cost to themselves. You know, they're giving up at least $3,450,000 in value right off the top of the purchase price. So, you know, and they're also saying they won't ever develop that property. So
that basically they were left with the property and now they either have to sell it or work into some way to protect the property so that they, I mean, how are they going to raise the money then to pay what's obligated from?
Well, that's what we're doing. So by selling a conservation easement, then they're able to satisfy these obligations that are due in March of 2018 and clean up things that were, you know, just left in their dad's estate, basically. You know, and it was a situation where an uncomfortable situation. And again, through no fault of their own, you know, these guys are farming and ranching and doing their deal. And some guy got a hold of dad and said, wow, you know, your property's worth a lot of money. And why don't you leave it to this institution? And dad said, sure, you know, and so tens of millions of dollars. And this institution came and said, okay, you owe us tens of millions of dollars. And the only way to meet that obligation initially would have been to sell the entire operation, put themselves out of business. Well, they didn't want to put themselves out of business. So they've been thinking outside of the box and really making an effort to try to save the ranch. And, you know, we're honored to be a part of that. And I hope that what's great about it is that their willingness to save this ranch dovetails so nicely with the community's stated objectives to save the ranch. So that's where we are right now, and we're looking for $5.5 million.
So how tough is that going to be? I mean, given what you had to raise for Bonanza Flat.
That's right. So the Summit Land Conservancy received about $590,000 in contributions towards Bonanza Flat. You know, and that was a massive effort across all of northern Utah. So this situation, you know, we feel like it's probably not quite as massive an effort because this is a Park City property, greater Park City property. And we feel like we're going to have to do some pretty heavy lifting right here.
Let's see. You also received some federal funding for two other conservation projects. Tell me about those.
That's right. You know, we've been really fortunate, and we've built an organization that can partner with the federal government, because property values here in Summit County are so high that we really feel like it's important to leverage the local dollars and bring in these federal monies. So this last year, we made applications for three projects. One of them was the Osgathorpe. The other two, one is in Hennifer. We've done several conservation projects in Hennifer, and this is in the same river corridor. It's, you know, one property up from previously protected landscapes. So we're going to increase the protected land along the Weber in Hennifer by about 90 acres. And then there's another just under 900 acres up outside of Colville. That is sagegrass habitat, and it's a heritage ranch.
So how much do you have to raise for those two properties?
Those two properties, it's a whole lot less. And in those situations, there are grants and funding sources that will help protect those farming and ranching properties. That, and one of them is the Eastern Summit County Agricultural Preservation Committee. And then we also go usually for Division of Wildlife Resources funding for those kinds of things. And those are not available on the Park City side.
So, again, how much do you have to raise then to protect those two easements?
That's a good question. About $800,000 or $900,000, I think.
Okay.
And maybe then, less than that.
And is there a deadline for those?
Those have a much longer deadline.
Okay.
A couple of years.
All right. Anything else?
It's a great month to get out and enjoy the beautiful open space. I feel like in October it's more beautiful than ever. October and May when the wildflowers are blooming. So, but do please respect the wet trails and try to make sure that we're being good stewards of our open space.
Okay, Cheryl, see you next month. Thanks.
Thank you.
KPCW News Time now, 8:21. Well, the Summit County Council meeting at the county courthouse in Colville tomorrow starting at about 3 o'clock. And on the phone is Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Leslie.
So you're on your way to Colville, I guess, to see the demolition there of the Quonset hut?
Well, I wish I was. I'm actually down for a military meeting this morning down in Draper, but I know that there's some of my staff are looking forward to that first step.
Okay. Real quick, the public notices show that the county council has been meeting with the Colville City Council, also with Oakley and Hennifer. What's the purpose of those meetings?
Well, they've been, you know, yearly, they've since I've been here, they've gone around on a regular basis to just visit with the councils, go over a few things that the county has been working on. This time they're kind of going over their strategic plan, some projects that are ongoing in the county that might be interest to specific cities. They're certainly talking a little bit about the possible raise in property taxes. And those are the main things that they're talking about.
Yesterday, you met with members of the Park City Board of Realtors to go over that proposed tax rate increase. What was their response from Realtors?
You know, they asked really good questions. Of course, the Board of Realtors and their membership is probably a little bit more in tune with the property tax burden to begin with. But you know, some weren't totally aware of how property taxes are calculated in the state, and some of the education that we're doing. So that was beneficial. And then you know, they just very pointed questions about you know the development that they hear is coming online, and how that produces property taxes.
Right. So when you've got some dates set out for when people are going to be able to get involved in asking questions and giving feedback?
Yeah. So besides the groups that we're going out to meet with, you know, the truth and taxation process itself has public meetings and public hearings set within that process. The first public meeting will be on October 11th at the council's regular meeting, where I would expect that the council will accept some public comment. And then during the budget adoption process in December will be the two public hearings that the council will hold.
Okay. Looking at the agenda, you'll be hearing from the South Summit School District. They're proposing a bond of more than $58 million to build a high school and improve their existing schools. Is this just informational, or is the school district looking for something from the council?
I don't think they're looking for anything specific from the council. I think this is just a public venue that they can inform both the public and the council about this project and answer any questions that the council might have.
All right. Council also being asked to amend the employee chart to add a position in the assessor's office. Any reason why you need to do it now rather than make a change in next year's budget?
Well, I think the assessor feels the need to get his staff filled up. In reality, what he's doing is it actually will allow us to draw down his budget a little bit, because this proposal actually saves money over his current chart of positions. So there might be some work that the assessor has done to pare down his budget a little bit. And this is a result of that. He'd like to, have that included in our budget process.
Okay. The council also possibly scheduled to adopt a resolution for its sustainability goals. They include county government becoming, or at least its operations, becoming 100% net renewable by 2032, reducing greenhouse gas emissions 80% below the 2014 level by the year 2015, bringing 50% of the county's passenger fleet to alternative vehicles by 2022. So at what cost are we doing this? Do we know that?
Well, Lisa Yoder has started to put some costs against this. I mean, this is going to cost money. There's no doubt about that. And so, and one of the questions that the council had along this process is how much it would cost. I think as we go into the specific plans, you'll notice the staff report also calls for a 2-year plan every 2 years on how we're specifically going to implement items in order to get to these goals. I think that's where we'll get into the real detailed cost analysis of that. But if the council is aggressive on these goals as they want to be, these things probably will cost us more money.
And so where is all of this coming from? I mean, are constituents really asking for all of this to happen, or is the council just taking it upon themselves to say that this is the right thing to do?
Well, I hear from constituents throughout the county that do want these things to be dealt with from a local level. And we're also talking to some of our other partners in the state that are advancing some of the similar goals. One of the things that is pretty exciting about this is the possibility of having a relationship with Rocky Mountain Power that would advance these goals in a way that may not end up costing that much money. I mean, if we can, as larger cities or counties that are interested in this, move Rocky Mountain Power's portfolio to having some renewable that would serve our citizens and serve our businesses and serve our governments, that doesn't necessarily cost that much money. We'll certainly have to put a price tag to that, but that's one of those items that would really move the needle. And I think the council's goal is to join, the Moabs, the Salt Lake City, and Park City, to try and convince Rocky Mountain Power that we've got some inertia behind that.
Yeah, certainly that's one of the hurdles the council has, though, is funding programs that, again, we cover nearly every county meeting that there is out there and have not heard this overwhelming desire, from constituents to say, this is what we need to do. And yet, here we have a council moving forward with these programs, and now in talking about increasing taxes. So I guess you got a big road ahead of you here to try and convince people that this is where we need to be spending tax dollars.
I think one of the things that we're going to have to look at is there other funding sources that we can draw upon, whether those be grant programs. Whether the legislature would allow different levels of taxes or different kinds of taxes, different kinds of districts in order to do some of these things, we're going to have to be creative because, again, you compare that against the arguments around just general and municipal property taxes and what they support. those things still need to support those basic services.
Let's see, an amendment to the Silver Creek Sewer Assessment Area. It looks like three properties now withdrawing from the area. How come?
Yeah, so the Bell Service Station is not ready to expand yet, and they actually own three properties there. They would like to withdraw two of those properties of their three. They're still going to hook up to sewer for their facility that they run now, and they'd like to back off a little bit, and probably as they go and remodel at some point, they will bring those back in. But at this point, they'd rather not pay that assessment. So a little bit of a backtrack on that, but we still expect to reach our goal of having the 25 properties in before the end of the assessment and have the revenue that would support that balloon payment at the end.
Is this the business, though, that was having to haul in outhouses because of some septic failure?
Yeah, I'm not sure specifically if it was that business, but we do know that business specifically was having to pump tanks in order to make sure that they weren't affecting groundwater. So that part of it, they are going to hook up and take care of that problem. So that won't be an issue. The properties that they're withdrawing are not developed right now.
All right. And you say it's a setback, but you think you're going to be okay in getting enough owners to...
Yeah, we still have enough properties that will likely hook up over the period of the bond and the assessment in order to make that happen.
Okay. And quickly here, I know you've probably got to get going, but there's a joint meeting with the Snyderville Planning Commission on a proposed amendment to the Silver Creek Village Plan. Basically, the developer would give five lots to Mountainlands Community Housing Trust. They would develop 281 affordable units. But there's a question if these units are being integrated enough into the village plan. The staff report says the two bodies will have a robust discussion about what is integrated. Before we talk about what integrated, let me just talk about why this is the proper process. Certainly on some occasions during public comment, people want to speak about applications before the Snyderville Planning Commission, but you've said we can't listen to you. This item might come before the council, but now you're hearing from Scott Loomis, whose item will be going before the council. So why is this okay now, but not in some other instances?
Well, it's because we've isolated an actual policy question that would relate to any development agreement that has language that supports the integration concept of our general plan, and that's really what they're talking about. Because the original proposal, Scott also has an alternative proposal that. Has more lots available from the two developers within that development that brings a different level of integration and would I guess allow a council to make a different determination about that. But the large issue is whether to what extent integration needs to happen, and it comes about because of the way that financing has to happen around some of these affordable housing projects in regards to tax credits. So, getting that clarification, not only for the Planning Commission and getting the Planning Commission and the Council to talk about those things together, it helps define this for this. Strategic need within the community that the council has identified. It also gives some guidance to the Planning Commission and staff from that policy side of how to process these types of things in the future.
So again, the Snyderville Planning Commission hasn't voted or made a recommendation on this. I mean, don't we run the risk of coloring their decision by the attitude they see from the county council members?
Well, I think we're certainly probably walking the line on this, but if we stick to the policy question of what does integration mean within this, understanding some of the other nuances around this, I think they'll be okay. And that's what the attorney's office has lined up for us.
Okay, Tom. Hey, appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you very much.
Summit County Manager Tom Fish. Well, coming up on Thursday at 7 o'clock, the Project for Deeper Understanding hosting another of its opportunities for a deeper discussion on a timely topic. This quarter's topic is fake news. In the studio with details, a couple of the organizers of the event, Mike Andrews and Dave Hederle-Smith. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So, David, when and where?
St. Luke's Church. That's the Episcopal Church behind the Blue Roof Market at 7 o'clock. 7 to 9 on Thursday afternoon, the 5th. It'll start sharply at 7 and it'll end sharply at 9.
Okay. Why this topic, Mike?
Well, I guess we can say that if there's anything in the news these days on the national scene and on the local scene, it's fake news. And what is fake news and what constitutes the reasonable discussion? And I think we're all aware of the fact that civil discourse has taken a very bad beating in the past year and a half. And again, what we're trying to do, as we always do with the Project for Deeper Understanding, is have a setting where people with differing viewpoints on what constitutes fake news or what is legitimate news. And actually, the question is, what is news in some instances? Is news just opinion? And we just feel that it is important to try to inform our electorate and our citizenry about the various aspects of news and how it can be manipulated. And we have a very, very good panel put together, headed up by George Pyle, who's the editorial writer and director for the Salt Lake Tribune, Ben Winslow of Channel 13, Stu Stanek of KNSR Radio, that's a very conservatively bent organization, Rob Huber, a tech expert from East Winds Networks, who will try to explain to us what things like bots are and how bots have influenced the news in the past year and during the past election. And we have Marsha Maxwell, who will be a University of doctoral candidate in journalism, and John Mejia of the ACLU. So we have a cross-section of opinions and viewpoints on the topic of what constitutes fake news.
Well, David, do we have a definition of what fake news is, or is it just because, I mean, someone says it's fake news makes it so?
Well, I don't know if we have a definition, but to me, fake news is when someone puts probably an untrue spin on something in order to advance their own personal social agenda, I guess. You know, you add a little something to a news story in hopes of getting other people's opinions to turn more your way.
Sure, and then people say, you know, that the New York Times and the Washington Post do it every day. They have a liberal bent agenda, and so they're always, just by what they're reporting, impacting what people see or read.
And on the other side, the same thing. If you read the Wall Street Journal, you're going to get a very different spin on the same. So the question becomes, is news simply someone's perspective or bias on an issue? Is that what constitutes news or fake news? So I don't know if I have an answer to that. I don't know if any of us do. But I think what we're trying to help our people understand is how you separate out opinion from actual fact.
Right. And I think it all comes down to trust, right? I mean, again, we're talking about institutions like the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, you know, that
right.
When you know, they win Pulitzer Prizes. I mean, they've obviously done something right. And yet, when we have, you know, the administration of our country telling us that it's fake news, I mean, again, it comes down to who do you believe and what makes it so?
And again, I guess in a very divided country as we are these days and social issues of all kinds separating us, it's very important for us as a an informed citizenry to be able to ferret out what is the truth. You know, yesterday I was watching my Facebook page and watching the stories come up on Facebook about the Las Vegas shootings. And some of those stories had absolutely no relationship to the facts that had occurred in Las Vegas. So how do we deal with organizations like Facebook and Twitter? And what is their responsibility in the general world of news and politics and opinion? And how do we make sure that what they're presenting to us is the real McCoy and not their spin?
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting phenomenon. I don't know who on your panel will be talking about kind of just that role of social media, but it's interesting. You know, people like certain people or certain pages. And again, then it just creates this sort of tunnel vision, and that's all you're getting fed.
That's absolutely true. And all of us, I think, you know, in our human nature, tend to look at things that we agree with and tend to go to those sites. And sometimes we know very little about the sites, as we're discovering during the past election with Russia buying up all kinds of space and time and on Twitter and Facebook. So where do we draw the line, and how do we draw the line?
I'm going to draw a quick anecdote. I had a friend visiting last week who teased me over the fact that I got most of my news from the TV networks and the newspaper and not on the Internet. And I can't think, but if you're getting all your news off the Internet, I don't think you're getting a very rounded perspective on things.
Because?
Because you go to where the people are telling the news the way you want to hear it. And, you know, what has happened to journalism where facts were always checked over and over and over? Now we do get national stories with anonymous sources that we later find out just flat out weren't true. You know, journalists used to recheck their sources and get confirmation two or three times. But now everybody wants to be the next Bob Woodward and, you know, get it out there first with your byline on it, I think.
Okay, so tell us just briefly about it. I mean, it starts at 7. There'll be just
At 7. We'll have 1 hour of panel discussion followed by an hour of questions from our audience, as we always do. And it will be aired on KPCW simultaneously. And we're looking forward to having a good turnout. It's a very, very important topic. And your general manager, Renee Bodley, will be our moderator for the evening. So we're looking forward to this and to our upcoming second discourse, which will take place on November 16th, which will be on the topic of DACA. And that's another important issue. So we hope, come on out, folks, and participate and listen and hopefully become better educated so that you are better consumers of real news.
Okay. Mike and David, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much, Liz.
KPCW News Time now, 8:44. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, coming up next week, the Park City Friends of the Library present Park City resident and author Jane Perkins. She'll be discussing her new book that she co-authored, The Golden Elixir of the West, Whiskey and the Shaping of America. Jane Perkins joins me now in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Thank you.
So start just with a little bit of background. Of course, you and your husband, David, built a very successful whiskey brand, High West, that sold last year. Was that at the point you decided you wanted to write a book?
Oh, no. The book had been basically the stories and the research for the book is what inspired us for not just starting the distillery, but a lot of the labels and a lot of the stories that we put together for the products. So when David came up with this amazing idea to quit his pharmaceutical marketing position and open up a whiskey distillery somewhere in the West, we had to answer the questions. Well, why the West? And then we chose Utah because we loved it. And everybody kept asking, you're kidding me, whiskey in Utah? Why Utah? And what people didn't realize is that there was a long history of whiskey being the main product that was basically found in all of the saloons, the epicenters of lots of the Rocky Mountain and the Western towns. And there were the big five movements. So the more research we did, we realized that all five movements, one century, that came out west, brought whiskey, and we kept thinking, why whiskey? And I'm without spoiling a lot of the story that's in the book, there's a big section about Utah's history. Specifically, it made sense economically. Leftover grains from crops, people would not waste that, and whiskey was a valuable commodity. It was flexible, tradable, had multiple uses. So we talk a lot about Utah's whiskey history, and that gave us evidence and a great solid foundation for why a distillery in Utah, and Park City was a no-brainer.
Yeah. So again, as you mentioned, whiskey seems to be synonymous with the West, and I certainly more so than vodka or tequila. And you're saying it's because of the grain, because of the corn and the rye, as opposed to the agave and potatoes?
Exactly. When you think of the West and you think of the agricultural foundations that were out here, people didn't grow tequila or grapes in the Rocky Mountain ranges. They grew grains. Wheat was primarily in Utah, corn, different areas depending on where you were, barley. It was the grains.
So if people have been up to the Blue Sky Ranch, they can learn a lot more about just how those grains are
absolutely
mashed and then
you're
fermented.
Right. We have a full tour up there that's incredible. And everybody that works at High West gives an in-depth story about the process of making whiskey.
So it's been said that distilleries have become the new microbreweries. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's following a trend. So think of coffee before that. There was people drank coffee. They didn't really appreciate where it came from. They didn't appreciate or understand the nuances of the bean and the variation in roasting. And once Starbucks and other craft coffee makers educated people, we began this trend, and it was synonymous, the foodie trend. And then following coffees were breweries and microbreweries and micro beers and an appreciation for hops and variations in brewing. And then after that, we only thought it was natural to appreciate the nuances of our American whiskey products, as people had appreciated scotch for quite some time. Vodka is what it is, but there's an amazing story and so much education. And rye whiskey, American brown spirits, that was our heritage. So a lot of that is told in the book, and a lot of it's in our story at High West and in Wanship, but it's an exciting, story.
So you co-authored a book with Sherry Monahan. What was that collaboration like? I mean, a friend or just somebody that she knew a lot about whiskey, or I don't know. Yeah.
No, it's a great story. So Dave and I started writing this book 4 or 5 years ago. We have had the idea, and we were thinking about all these great fun facts and interesting things. We started trying to put it together, and it's difficult. Writing a book was really challenging, and it was just another thing that we were doing that took up so much time. And I got together with a group of wonderful creative people and came up with this idea that it needed to be a collaboration. Dave and I know whiskey. We know a lot of the stories we wanted to tell, but we wanted somebody equally passionate about the West. And so in that creative idea, I reached out to some of the people that I really respect that are amazing American Western writers, and got a call back from one of them who said, you know what, you need to meet Sherry Monahan. And I said, perfect. Send her my way. We connected. She said, hey, I'll come out. I just wrote a book about California wine history. I definitely know the characters. And Sherry stayed at my house. We spent 3 or 4 days researching together, telling stories, exchanging interesting facts, and definitely tasting a lot of whiskey. And she was sold, and I was in, and I loved her approach. So it was hard writing with somebody, but it was a great collaboration.
Great. Yeah. Book just came out.
Yep, this week. Hot off the press.
Yeah. Awesome. So, and the books will be available at the Friends Luncheon.
Library. They are at Dolly's now. And I think Dolly's will have some at Friends of the Library, yes.
Okay. Again, that happens October 10th. It starts at 11 a.m. at Silver Lake Lodge. Tickets are $36, available now at the Park City Library. After October 6th, they do go up to $40, so get your tickets now. Okay. We'll see you next Tuesday.
Thank you. Thanks, Leslie.
It's 8:52 now. Good morning. Well, the Shop Yoga Studio presenting two upcoming events this month and next. In the studio with details, I have yoga instructor Tiffany Wood. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So first this month, October 10th, 11th, and 12th, it's Resilient Relationships with a gentleman, John Kenyon. So maybe talk about who he is and what he'll be talking about for 3 days.
John Kenyon is, I've never met him, but he came highly recommended by one of my cohorts who... she and I have been working on creating a conflict resiliency framework for the Anasara School of Hatha Yoga. And we brought John in. He's the creator of Mediate Your Life. He's written the book that he's written is called From Conflict to Connection, and it's about transforming difficult conversations into peaceful resolution. So it's sort of taking the concept of, from the yoga perspective, that conflict is a part of life. It happens. Every one of us knows what it's like to not want to have a conversation with somebody. And then we come up against our limited skill sets to take something that doesn't feel good or creates actual divide between ourselves. And so this workshop is about learning skills to remove barriers to communication.
And so who would benefit from this? I mean, is it for professional mediators or maybe someone in the middle of a divorce? Or, I mean, how do you see it?
I'm going to see it as an opportunity for people who are professional mediators to come in and hone in their skills and maybe get some continuing education. But it is absolutely for the layman. That's our intention was for initially for yoga studio owners and managers who... you know, come up against the same challenges and barriers to conflict or communication that all of us do. But we really know that we are a global family as humans, you know, and the more we can learn to communicate, the better we get at that. It's just going to make everything better for everyone. So it's for all of us.
So is there a yoga component to this or is it?
No, not that. I mean, yoga from what perspective? no asana practice, no physical yoga. It's but it is the yoga to me is learning to live life more skillfully and to take what's inside your heart and inside the intention and the way you want to live and actually give it a pathway.
So it's not cheap. $395 for the full 3 days.
Correct.
And that so it's is it. More like a classroom setting then?
It is a classroom setting. I just got the manuals yesterday. It was incredible to me that in 3 days we're going to unpack as much information as he has in this manual. Maybe we won't get to it all, but it was really, I was like, oh, wow, it was really exciting to see it in black and white, what we're going to be uncovering.
Okay. People can register for that. How?
You can get on my website. It's tiffanywoodyoga.com.
All right. And then next month, it's Experience the Heart of Daily Life, and you're bringing in Bill Mahoney. So tell me about him.
Bill Mahoney is one of my primary philosophy teachers. To engage in the yoga practice with him is one of my greatest delights because it is purely his greatest delight. He's a professor of contemplative studies and religion at Davidson College in North Carolina, and we'll be unpacking an 11th century text, tantric Shaivism text. It's called the Pratyabhijna Haridam, and in English, that means the heart of recognition.
All right, and when you say unpacking this 11th century text, what does that mean? I mean,
it means that in order to really understand what the great sages wrote centuries ago, we need someone who has studied it, practiced it. It's a tradition that's been handed down from teacher to student, and to help us make sense of these. It's just wisdom teachings that we get. Really, they're called sutras. They're threads, and there's 20 sutras. In this particular text, And each sutra, you could, you could take a month if you wanted to digest it yourself, just to sit and contemplate. And there's practices in there, meditation practices. And that's one of my favorite pieces, is to take some of these really just pearls of wisdom and see how you can embody them.
So this text is what, from India? Is that where?
It's from Kashmir. It's from India. It's from the 11th century. Kashmir Shaivism is a particular branch of the tantric practice, which tantric practice means something very different than what most people relate it to.
Okay. This is a little bit different than the first one happening this month. It's lots of different sessions for people to be part of, or?
Yes, the two workshops, they couldn't be more similar or more different, if you want to look at them from that way, because they're both about living life more skillfully. And this one, The Heart of Recognition with Bill Mahoney, it's about taking the practice of yoga into our daily life, which is a tantric yogic perspective. We're not here to live in a cave and disappear. We have to be householder yogis. That's what we are. How do we do that more skillfully? And to do it really heart-centered.
Okay, so people can experience all 3 days, again, for $295. But again, if you're just looking for kind of a yoga and maybe a seminar, you can piece two of those together as well?
So with the Bill Mahoney workshop, yes, you can take individual sessions. We've pieced it out for separate sessions. It starts Friday night, November 10th, and each session is priced individually, or you can come and take the whole thing. If you wanted to just show up for maybe one part of it to see if this is your cup of tea, if you're into meditation, if you're into the deeper, you want to deepen your knowledge of where did yoga come from, how does it relate to me, I would come on Friday night and let Bill just blast your heart right wide open, and you'll probably want to come back.
Okay. Again, that's TiffanyWood.com.
TiffanyWoodYoga.com.
Okay. All right. Hey, Tim, thanks for coming in.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much.